Okay, this is Jeff Spittler, November 25th, 2001, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, number 47, Alexander Henderson, part 2. Okay, I brought a couple things here. This is from Naphtali Press, an issue that has some sermons from Henderson. So this is a picture of him. This is volume 3, number 2. I'm sure it's in your collection, Dave. Oh, yeah. So, that's a picture of Henderson. And on a not-so-serious note, I would like you all to see this picture from the Scots Worthies. Oops, I guess it's not. Thought I had my bookmarker in there. In this book, which Scots Worthies, which are, you know, short biographies of a number of the Scottish, Covenanters, but goes back as far as Knox and even earlier, and then on through at least through 1688. But there's also, besides the portraits of the people that they're referred to, there's also portraits of other people. And somewhere in here, there's a portrait of the Earl of Traquair. Well, this will be... Well, it's too bad. My picture is ruined. We'll have to look later at it. No, it's not worth it. You've just got to see it. I want to call your attention to a certain resemblance to a contemporary character, which may explain everything. But maybe we'll look for it later, or we'll sign Anna to look for it. But yeah. Okay, so we left off last time at the Glasgow General Assembly of November 1638. This is the one where the King's Commissioner had refused to try to... he had been refused when he tried to close the assembly, and they went on and overthrew much of the innovations forced upon the church by James and Charles. And Henderson told the assembly in his closing address, "Now we are quit of the service book, which was a book of slavery and service indeed. The book of canons, which tied us in spiritual bondage. The book of ordination, which was a yoke put upon the necks of faithful ministers. And the high commission, which was a guard to keep us all under that slavery. All these evils God has rid us of, and likewise the civil places of kirkmen, the places of bishops in parliament, which was the splendor of all these evils, and the Lord has led captivity captive and made lords slaves. What should we do less than resolve first, since the Lord has granted us liberty, to labor to be sensible of it and take notice of it? Take heed of a second defection, and rather endure the greatest extremity than be entangled again with the yoke of bondage." Okay, then closed the assembly with a prayer. They sang Psalm 133, and he pronounced the benediction. And then he gave this famous warning: "We have now cast down the walls of Jericho. Let him that rebuildeth them beware of the curse of Hiel the Bethelite." So, but in another, 1638 to 1680, roughly, you know, the walls, they were rebuilding the walls, so to speak. Okay, well, the Scots began to prepare for war, as we discussed before. Alexander Henderson was busy writing their justification for taking up arms, and this booklet, I guess, was called Instructions for Defense of Arms. Let's see, quoting McLeod here, Henderson emphasizes that he is not speaking of subjects rising or standing out against law and reason, that they may be freed from the yoke of their obedience, but of a people holding fast their allegiance to the sovereign and in all humility supplicating for religion and justice. A distinction should be put, he says, between some private persons taking arms of resistance, and counselors, barons, peers of the land, parliament, and the whole body of the kingdom, except some few courtiers, statesmen, papists, and popishly affected, and their adherents standing to their own defense. So this would be sort of the lesser magistrate justification for armed resistance. Henderson concludes that such defense is lawful. He refers to the unreasonableness of court parasites who maintain that princes, against the strongest bonds of oaths and laws, may do what they please to the ruin of religion, the kirk, the kingdom, the lives and liberty of some or all of their subjects, and that the people shall do nothing but either flee, which is impossible, or suffer themselves to be massacred. And in language reminiscent of that of John Knox to Queen Mary, he went on, if a private man by the law of nature may be found entitled to defend himself against the prince or judge as a private man, invading him by violence, and may repel violence by violence, if children may resist the violent invasion of their parents against themselves, notwithstanding the straight obligation between parents and children, if servants may hold the hands of their masters, seeking to kill them in a rage, then much more may the whole body defend themselves against all invasions whatsoever. Okay, so again, Henderson provided a lot of the sort of intellectual background there. So shortly after the Scots army entered England, Charles gave up and went to negotiations, since he was both outmanned and outsupplied by the Scots. Henderson was one of the commissioners who negotiated with the king, and apparently the English were somewhat surprised that Henderson wasn't the firebrand they had been led to believe. Charles, of course, was just playing for time. He acted somewhat disingenuously, so that nothing was really settled by the First Bishop's War, which was June 3rd to 11th, 1639. Okay, so shortly thereafter, in August of 1639, a general assembly was held in Henderson's church, which was now St. Giles in Edinburgh. And this is the general assembly where the king acted as if nothing had been settled the previous general assembly, because he didn't approve it. So they repeated much of the official acts, and the king also switched back from Hamilton to the Earl of Traquair. Any sign of his picture yet, Mrs. Edmondson?
Who's the name of this guy?
Earl of Traquair.
Earl of Traquair.
I'll get there.
Okay. Well, anyways, it's not too important. But I thought I had a bookmark, but obviously my bookmark was someplace else. Okay. Henderson he preached the opening sermon. This is why I thought Alan would have to preach the opening sermon next time. And at one point addressed the Earl of Traquair, "We beseech your grace to see that Caesar have his own, but let him not have what is due to God, by whom kings reign. God has exalted your grace to many high places within these few years, and is doing so more especially now. Be thankful and labor to exalt Christ's throne. Some are exalted like Haman, some like Mordecai. And I pray God that these eminent parts wherewith he hath endowed you may be used aright. When the Israelites came out of Egypt, they gave all the silver and gold they carried thence for the building of the tabernacle. In like manner, your grace must employ all your parts and endowments for building up the church of God in this land." Okay, did you find the picture of the Earl of Traquair there? Now, I think everything is explained, and future Scottish historians should take note that I made this discovery. He bears an uncanny resemblance to Gilligan.
Oh, no.
Oh, look at him. And that probably explains, if you think about it, that explains quite a bit.
Oh.
Oh, well, maybe future Scottish historians won't know what I'm talking about since they never saw the TV program Gilligan's Island. But okay. Anyways, back to more serious serious considerations here. Henderson went on to speak to the members of the assembly to encourage them to go on in your zeal constantly. Surely it shall be a refreshment to you and your children that you should have lived in when the light of the gospel was almost extinguished, and now to see it quickened again. After all these troubles, with a holy moderation, go on, for zeal is a good servant but an ill master, like a ship that has a full sail but wants a rudder. We have need of Christian prudence, for ye know what ill speeches our adversaries have made upon us. I think one thing that marks Henderson's career is that he did have a great deal of prudence. He had zeal, but knew how to use it as a servant rather than as master. Okay, there was then some debate over who the next moderator should be. The Earl of Traquair wanted Henderson to be moderator. And, you know, this might have been due to the fact that the king just wanted to see a talented moderator managing the meeting, perhaps. But many suspect the king wanted to set a precedent by appointing a moderator. Okay, even if it was one that maybe he wouldn't have appointed if he had his druthers. Henderson himself refused, saying, "It savors of a constant moderator, the first step of episcopacy, and in truth I have no mind to be a bishop." And accordingly, David Dixon was elected moderator. David Dixon wrote the commentary, is that on Psalms, that the Banner of Truth publishes? It's there. What series is that?
The Geneva series.
The Geneva series, yeah. Okay, so they again reaffirmed the acts passed by the last assembly, and during this assembly, Henderson suggested what has been referred to as the first barrier act. Okay, and this appeared in Macleod, just saying that Henderson had proposed the first barrier act. Does anybody know what a barrier act is? No, I didn't think so. That's what the Dictionary of Scottish Church History and Theology is useful for. Okay, well, this act requires that changes to the church constitution be sent down for approval to lower courts of the church, at least to synods and presbyteries. And referring to the Barrier Act of the Church of Scotland in 1697, which claimed as precedence acts of earlier assemblies, the Dictionary of Scottish Church History and Theology entry on the Barrier Act says, "Delegating power from the superior court to the inferior was astonishing for its day and peculiar to Scottish Presbyterianism. Wherever Scottish Presbyterianism has had any influence, the Barrier Act or a similar measure is to be found." Right, so presumably this is the background for our own requirement, which is in the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America Book of Discipline. Any proposal of change in the fundamental law of the church, if adopted by synod by a two-thirds vote, shall be submitted to the sessions of the congregations. So again, it goes down to the to a lower level. And in that, the entry, they muse somewhat on what the background of this might have been, and apparently there's some earlier analogous thing in Scottish government where they would turn things down to a lower level and thinks that might be the idea. But the name Barrier Act, I mean, it does provide a barrier to sort of people going in, say, to the General Assembly meeting and changing something, like getting the five Articles of Perth installed and so on.
It also helps to keep synods from being swayed by current events and fundamentally making fundamental changes that are just based on the times.
Yeah.
People being swept up in the stitch about something, because it just takes time for all the other votes and such, and over larger bodies than it's likely to do.
It's one reason why the wheels of the Presbyterian system grind exceedingly slowly, but exceedingly fine.
You can tar and feather your elder.
That's true. You don't have to.
Well, following the assembly, Henderson preached to the Scottish Parliament, and they went on to confirm the acts of the General Assembly, though the king wouldn't agree later. This was the Parliament where the king had expected Traquair to retain the king's prerogative in some way, but as I think Stephen said, typically Traquair had miscalculated, and he lost control of the Parliament. Later in the year, Henderson was appointed rector of the University of Edinburgh by the city council, and a silver mace was to be borne before him in all solemnities. That'd be kind of nice to have somebody march around in front of you with a silver mace. Okay, well, through the rest of 1639 and up to August of 1640, events spiraled downward again towards the second Bishop's War. Eventually, this resulted in the Covenanter army entering England defensively, of course, not, you know. with Henderson as one of the chaplains. And Henderson, again, was riding I suppose one way of putting it would be propaganda, but writing the sort of reasoning for their course of action. In this case, he wrote this document called Six Considerations of the Lawfulness of Our Expedition into England Manifested. And that was then printed and distributed in England. Let's see, he said, quoting from it, in this case, to send new commissioners a submission or supplication to the king were against experience and hopeless. To maintain an army on the borders is above our strength and cannot be a safety unto us by sea. To retire homewards were to call on our enemies to follow us and to make ourselves and our country a prey by land, as our goods and ships are made at sea. We are therefore constrained at this time to come into England, not to make war, but for seeking our relief and preservation. Your grievances are ours, speaking to the English people. The preservation or ruin of religion and liberties is common to both nations. We must now stand or fall together. We come to get assurance of our religion and liberties and peace against invasion, and that the authors of all our grievances and yours being tried in Parliament and our wrongs redressed, the two kingdoms may live in greater love and unity than ever before. Okay, that, again, the Second Bishop's War was settled with, I think, as I recall, a single battle. Ceasefire was negotiated after a single battle, and then a peace treaty was negotiated with English Parliament as being one of the parties. Henderson was appointed one of the peace commissioners. He spent 9 months in England negotiating the peace treaty. He, doing the negotiation, he preached often, and he got to know many of the Presbyterian-minded brethren in London. I might call them Presbyterians, but I'm not. There really wasn't a Presbyterian church in England yet, but there were a number of ministers and so on who were very sympathetic, and we'll just call them Presbyterians for short, but even though it might be a little anachronistic. While they were there, the Scottish commissioners wrote a proposal to establish, quote, unity in religion and uniformity in church government as a special means for conserving a peace between two kingdoms. Henderson prepared a background paper that was considered by the English Parliament, although they decided to go their own way at their own pace, at least for the time being. And here I think we see the seeds of later developments, especially the Solemn League and Covenant. In the years immediately following that, he would communicate officially with the London Presbyterians, representing the Church of Scotland. In the Scottish Church General Assembly of 1641, Henderson was directed to answer a letter requesting advice from these men. Foreseeing that the church in England was likely to undergo further reformation, he also moved that the General Assembly draw up a confession of faith, catechism, directory for worship, and form of church government that could serve as a basis for unity between the two churches. That was his original idea, was that they would draw up something and the English could, you know, sort of mark it up, as it were. You know, they'd have a basis for negotiation. I think later he changed his mind and decided it would be best if they wrote something that came out of England. That's what happened in the Westminster Assembly. His motion was approved by the Assembly, and since, you know, as all these things were, he was designated to develop the initial draft, because after all, he made the motion. Yeah. I guess Calvin is going to drink his bottle after all. Okay, so, but again, this is sort of the seeds of further of later development. So if you remember when the English commissioners came up and negotiated the Solemn League and Covenant, it all happened in less than three weeks. And I suspect that a reason this happened quickly is because it wasn't something that they just thought up that, you know, minute, but rather there had been a lot of discussion previous to that. Okay, the English Civil War began in fits and starts, but the king raised the standard at Nottingham in August of 1642. There had been some skirmishes and so on before then. But after the outbreak of hostilities, Henderson accompanied the Earl of Loudoun to see the king in a last-ditch effort to mediate, and it was unsuccessful. The king first was friendly, but then when he saw that he wasn't going to persuade Henderson, he turned cold. But I think he kept them talking for 2 months, and I think that was part of his strategy, was to stall them. I guess I didn't mention this, but Charles had been in Scotland, I think it was in 1641, and he actually had Henderson appointed as his chaplain. He actually sat under Henderson's preaching. And he seemed to like Henderson, but didn't change his mind. Let's see. Okay, so through the fall of 1642 and the spring of 1643, at least, the war didn't go particularly well for the parliamentary faction. It looked very bleak. They called the Westminster Assembly in June of 1643. Actually, for almost a year, there had been some discussion between England, the English Parliament, and Scotland. And the summer came and went. The Convention of Estates was meeting, and they were expecting these English representatives, and they never came. People began to wonder if they were ever going to come, since almost a year had elapsed. The 26th of July, Bristol, which was then England's second greatest city, fell to the Royalists. And then just a couple weeks later, on the 7th of August, the English commissioners arrived in Edinburgh. Convention of Estates was no longer meeting, but the General Assembly was meeting, and Alexander Henderson was again moderator. And their primary mission was to obtain military aid. They knew from recent history, though, that they'd have to make some kind of agreement to bring the churches into closer conformity. Robert Bailey wrote, if this was Pym, the parliamentary leader, bring no satisfaction to us quickly, it will be a great impediment to their affairs here. So in addition to the representatives of the House of Lords and House of Commons, they also sent two members of the Westminster Assembly, Stephen Marshall and Philip Nye. Both of these men were very active in the affairs of the Assembly. They were ones who spent, you know, quite active debating and chairing committees and so on. Marshall was somewhat of a supporter of Presbyterianism. Hetherington says he occasionally supported the independent position, but reading through all the different arguments that he fell out on, it looked to me like it was pretty consistent on the Presbyterian side. Nye was one of the leading independents. And interesting question, which I haven't been able to answer, is whether or not Stephen Marshall and Alexander Henderson had previously been in correspondence. Don't know. Be interesting to find out. Okay, along with the commission that they had giving them authority to negotiate, the English commissioners also presented a letter from the Westminster Assembly and a letter written by about 70 members of the Westminster Assembly supplicating aid in their desperate condition. This letter, says Bailey, was so lamentable that it drew tears from many. Okay, the English commissioners requested that the Scots send representatives to Westminster Assembly, and of course Alexander Henderson was one of the representatives, along with Robert Bailey, Robert Douglas, George Gillespie, Samuel Rutherford, of the other ministers, and some lay members. One of who was Archibald Johnston of Worston, which I guess we'll get to him later. The other one was Maitland, who went. And later, interestingly enough, I don't know too much of his history, but later he ended up running the government while the in Scotland for the Charles II while the Covenanters were being persecuted. Henderson was very reluctant to go. His health was so poor that he thought he might not survive the trip down. However, he did agree to go, and he did survive the trip down. He just barely survived the return trip a few years later, though. Okay, well, Henderson drafted the Solemn League and Covenant, and on the 17th of August, it was brought before the entire General Assembly, where he gave a most grave oration to the assembly. He read the document twice, then he called on a number of members, both ministers and elders, to give their opinions. They all spoke favorably, and the General Assembly went on to approve it unanimously. Later the same day, it was approved by the Commission of Estates. Okay, Henderson sailed for London at the end of August, 1643, and he spoke to the House of Commons and the Westminster Assembly, and quoting from his speech, when the prelates were grown intolerably insolent, and when the people of God were brought so low that they chose rather to die than live in such slavery, then did the Lord say, I have seen the affliction of my people, and have heard their groaning, and have come down to deliver them. The beginnings were small and contemptible in the eyes of the presumptuous enemies, but were so seconded and continually followed by the undeniable evidence of divine providence, leading them forward from one step to another, that their mountain became strong in the end. No tongue can tell what motions filled the hearts, what tears poured from the eyes, when they found an unwonted flame warming their breasts and creating for them a new world wherein should dwell religion and righteousness. When they were destitute of monies and munition, the Lord brought them forth out of his hid treasures, which was wonderful in their eyes and matter of astonishment to their hearts. When they were many times at a pause in their deliberations and brought to such perplexity that they knew not what to choose to do for prosecuting the work of God, only their eyes were toward him. Their devices were turned upon their own heads and served for the promoting of the work of God. All which were sensible impressions of the good providence of God and legible characters of his work, which has the Church and Kingdom of England exercised at this time with greater difficulty than difficulties than theirs, have in part already found, so shall the parallel be perfected to their greater comfort in the faithful pursuing of the work unto the end. Okay, and then on, let's see, September 25th, the House of Commons and the Westminster Assembly subscribed the Solemn League and Covenant. The English Parliament then got the Scottish Army to fight on their side. What difference that made, we discussed earlier. Let's see. MacLeod summarizes the succeeding events as, I think, well, while the Westminster Assembly was in progress, the Parliamentary Army took control of the military situation, and Cromwell, with a strongly independent outlook, rose to prominence on the field in the House of Commons. Then all hopes that Presbyterianism would be set up in England and that the Scottish and English churches might come into closer union were doomed to disappointment. Parliament did indeed vote in January 1645 that the Church of England should become Presbyterian, but Bailey believed it was only a kind of nominal presbytery, and except for London and Lancashire, the scheme never really got off the ground. Okay, at the Westminster Assembly itself, Henderson was one of the divines who was often quiet, likely due to his poor health. He suffered from what was called in the language of 17th century repeated attacks of the gravel. I'm not sure what that is. I hope it's not kidney stones. It sounds painful. And at times he spoke eloquently, for example, when the office of elder was being debated. Another time, Nye, the commissioner, had come to Scotland to negotiate the help of the Scots army and had agreed to the Solemn League and Covenant, spoke out against Presbyterianism, declaring it to be incompatible with civil government. Henderson replied with a quote, speech of devastating energy and eloquence. He carried the sympathy of the assembly, and Nye was censured. Henderson also was able on several occasions to help reconcile conflicting parties in the assembly. helping them to find some kind of mutually agreeable wording to express their position. There was another time when he had noted that the debate was unnecessarily fiery, and actually held a meeting to try to figure out how to do a better job to have more moderate speech, and seems to have been successful. Let's see, while he was there in London, he preached at least three times to the English Parliament, of which I quoted from one of those, and two of the sermons are recorded in McCree's biography of Henderson. In early 1645, he was pressed to be involved again in negotiations with the king, this time in Uxbridge. No, Simon Nagius. Pronunciation must be tolerable. Okay. He was reluctant to leave the assembly, but went anyways. He met with the king and argued against episcopacy. Now, I mean, I guess the thing was, is there were other commissioners who must have talked to the king about other things. But whenever Henderson went, it was always like debating episcopacy. So this time he argued that it wasn't necessary, okay, and that it was, and that it had caused numerous problems, because apparently the king earlier had conceded to him that it wasn't necessary to support the Christian religion. Now the king really felt it was necessary to support him, but the negotiations broke down, and he returned to the Westminster Assembly. Let's see, in May of 1646, he headed for home by way of Newcastle, where once again he argued with the king. Charles, at this point, had surrendered to the Scottish army, so you might have thought that he would have been more open to compromise, but, you know, if there ever a man who reminds you of Pharaoh, he's a good example. Let's see. McClee had summarized this I thought again well. Therefore, 7 weeks from the middle of May, he discussed church government with the king, with the more formal part of their argument being carried out by an exchange of letters. And this, this exchange of letters is available from Stillwater's Revival. I ordered it, but you know they don't exactly give overnight service. So. Hasn't come yet. So, Charles had asked Henderson to debate in his presence with certain Episcopal divines, but Henderson objected that such disputations are seldom successful in bringing controversies to an end. Henderson argued, of course, from the Scriptures, but Charles based his case on the universal consent of the Church Fathers, although he could not claim to be familiar with them. The king maintained that the consent and the practices of the early church should be accepted as the final arbiter in controversy. There one could find the genuine interpretation of Scripture. Bailey stated that no man was so meet as Mr. Henderson for these negotiations, but neither of the parties came any closer to the other. Perhaps for Charles it was no more than an interesting intellectual exercise. But he told Henderson that he had, quote, an uncommon esteem for his learning, piety, and solidity. Henderson replied modestly, "It is your Majesty's royal goodness and not my merit that hath made your Majesty to conceive any opinion of my abilities, which ought in all duty to be improved for your Majesty's satisfaction. And this I intended in my coming here at this time by a free yet modest expression of the true motives inducements which drew my mind to the dislike of Episcopal government, wherein I was bred in my younger years in the university." Before they parted, Henderson told the king, "While Archimedes was drawing his figures and circlings in the sand at Syracuse, Marcellus interrupted his demonstrations. 'Sir, were I worthy to give advice to your majesty, or to the kings and supreme powers on earth, my humble opinion would be that they should draw the minds, tongues, and pens of the learned to dispute about other matters than the power or prerogative of kings and princes. And in this kind your majesty has suffered and lost more than will easily be restored to yourself or your posterity for a long time.' And needless to say, Charles did not listen. The one thing that mattered more to him more than anything else was his supreme power over the church as well as over the state." You know. And Robert Bailey, who we may do a biography of later, one of the reasons he's quoted a lot for the history at this time is because he wrote extensive amounts of letters that are that I guess he kept copies of, and there's I think three volumes of letters. So, but he was writing letters to Henderson at the time, which kind of reflect on the king's situation. So Bailey was in London writing letters to Henderson, and apparently these letters are, it seems likely they were meant for the king's ears. Okay, so in April of 1646, Bailey wrote to Henderson, "The prevalent party desires nothing so much as the king's refusing of any one of the propositions. It is the sense of all I meet with that if the king should but delay to grant the propositions, this people will declare against him and reject him forever from being king. Though he should swear it, no man will believe it that he sticks upon episcopacy for any conscience." May 19th. "There is much talk here of the king's obstinacy. The faction rejoices herein. If he would do his duty in spite of all knaves, all would in a moment go right. But if God has hardened him, this people will strive to have him in their power and make an example of him." In July, "Your debates upon episcopacy I never took to be conscientious, but merely politic and a pretense to gain time. I hear France has or will loose that scruple of conscience very easily. Will such base hypocrisy be blessed? The passing of the proposition for episcopacy will not do your turn now. You have that good property to do all out of time. Sir, if you have any power, let that man, the king, come off at once very frankly in all things, and he shall have all he ought to desire. Will he do it by halves and quarters? He is running to utter destruction. Who can help it? Yet I must be one of the mourners for it. Sir, give over your disputations. They are but vain." Okay, and McCree goes on to say that Henderson communicated this information to His Majesty, for whose ear it seems to have been intended, but it had no effect upon him. I mean, knowing, of course, we can look back and know that Charles was going to get executed, you know, and here they're basically, you know, pleading with him that if he'll just unharden his heart, as it were, you know, that he'd be restored to power and everything would be made right, but that if he continued, it wouldn't go well for him. But being the offspring of James, never really learned his lesson. It's not surprising that he didn't change. Well, with the negotiations with the king going nowhere, Henderson finally left Newcastle and he sailed for Edinburgh. He arrived on the 11th of August, 1646, and his health was failing. 8 days later, on the 19th, and this is McCree, on the 19th of August, he rested from his labors, sickness and sorrow being mercifully taken away from seeing the evils which were approaching, and the interruption which God in His wise sovereignty was pleased to give to that work, in the promotion of which he had been so zealous and useful. So Henderson died and left. He actually never married, left no heirs. He had a nephew that buried him and erected a little monument, which was then defaced at the Restoration and later rebuilt, supposedly in Greyfriars Churchyard, I think. I don't remember seeing it there, but then again, I didn't look at all the monuments when I was there, so it might be there somewhere. And that's all for Alexander Henderson. So, any questions? Let's see. I think he was in his 60s. Well, he was born about 1583, so yeah, he would have been about 63. So for that day,
pretty old.
I mean,
was he in London the whole time he's been there?
Well, no, he went for sure. He went to Uxbridge the one time, and he left before the assembly finished meeting. Of course, he didn't arrive until after they'd started. I'm not sure if he was recalled to Scotland at all during the assembly or not. Some of the commissioners were recalled to go back and sort of report to the General Assembly. His health would, you know, was very bad, so I don't know that they would have called him back like that. But they did press him to go meet with the king. Apparently, they thought the king would listen to him. The king seemed to have some respect for him, you know. So, just not enough respect to see straight.
What was the last assembly he moderated?
1641, I think. That would have been the... Or no, 1643, I'm sorry. Ah, this is my problem. I got my notes out of order here. Yeah, the Edinburgh Assembly is 1643. So, as far as I know, only that moderated the two assemblies. So.
Mike. In your reading there, do you ever get the sense that Charles ever thought that he would be executed or could be executed? Is that just totally out of his comprehension?
I don't know. That's a good question, whether or not Charles, you know, understood that there was a threat. And I don't really, you know, I don't really know. I mean, obviously, at some point he must have figured it out, but it seems to have been pretty far from his mind, I guess, at this point. I mean, one supposes that if he knew that the Scots army would then turn him over to the English and they would execute him, that he wouldn't have surrendered. That he would have preferred to have sailed off, but he was very bullheaded.
There were other English divines at the time trying to convince him, many of the independents working in Cromwell, and peace emissaries and others who tried to meet with him, that just didn't want anything to do with him.
Yeah, well, given the nature of the English situation, you know, one would have been surprised if he hadn't just, if he'd said, well, we're going to do the English church this way, but you all can meet on your own if you'd like. You know, they probably would have been thrilled. They're all independents, and that's really sort of the final outcome anyways. But, yeah, I know he...
Were there any scandals then attached to Henderson's name?
After he died, some of the prelates said that he changed his mind, and then he decided at the end he decided he favored episcopacy, and they published this. But he was later cleared of that by a general assembly as being a falsehood. But you know, somebody wrote up this, you know, basically tract saying, you know, that he changed his mind at the end and decided episcopacy was right.
Similar to Bonson passing away, and everybody said, well, now my schedule's free, I can make him.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, yeah, but other than that, no, I don't think so. And there were a few other minor things where people disagreed with him. Let's see, some people didn't think he should have served as the king's chaplain. He got some salary for it. I mean, I don't remember what it was, but it was hardly being made. He was hardly made wealthy by it. But as far as I can tell, he did his duty as chaplain to somebody who wouldn't listen. You know, so. You know, considering that Charles at least did, I mean, I say he wouldn't listen, Charles at least did listen to him some, even if he didn't, you know, didn't change his mind. But, I mean, you know, he did actually come before Charles a number of times and sort of argue, you know, with him politely about it. There was one other thing, in a Scottish parliament where some people felt he had protected somebody that shouldn't be protected or something like that. It was... seemed like a fairly minor thing, so I don't.
It's a pretty impressive career.
Yeah, well, he was. I mean, he's often said to be the sort of the foremost light of the Second Reformation. And you see, he drafted all these documents, and considering his start coming into the church through broken window, and being in a very small parish for a number of years, but he obviously read quite a bit and studied and was prepared. And he also, I think he also exemplified this concept of a Christian who argues but does it with humility and politely and, you know, without getting angry and so on, and does it in a way that people don't take as offense as easily. You know, I mean, they still will take offense, but not as if you do it in an ungracious manner. So, and I think that's one of the reasons why he was also, probably one of the reasons why he was chosen for the king's chaplain. And you know, chosen to go negotiate with the king and to moderate the assembly. When things were at a critical juncture, he was the moderator of the General Assembly. And again, I think I like his quote about zeal being a good servant but an ill master. You know, so that's sometimes you see people who are, you know, zealous, but ends up mastering them rather than serving them. So. Okay, well, let's stop there. And Scott, would you close us in prayer?